afterwards. And I was sober whenever I was around her because it didn't make sense for me to get fucked up if she wasn't going to party with me. But I got bored. I liked doing drugs. And Aaron developed some health problems and had some surgeries and started taking painkillers. So during Darla's early years, our communication kind of stopped and our drug use and arguing increased. Our problems began long before Darla, back when Fat Records started becoming successful. Money can turn you into a dick. You expect things to go your way, and when they don't, you can throw money at them until they do. The more money we had, the shorter our patience became. And we weren't just living together, we were working together every day. So we clashed over the business as well as the personal. Eventually, we started driving to work in separate cars. Money and work and drug use were just the tip of the iceberg. It became obvious to everyone around us that our marriage was in trouble. But we had been together for so long we couldn't imagine being apart. Darla was the perfect distraction to keep us from dealing with the real issues that were developing, as was a phone call telling me my father had died. Epitaph owed me $360,000 between my performance advance and mechanical advance for our So Long and Thanks for All the Shoes album. I asked them to combine both advances into one check so I could show it to my dad. Why the hell would I do that? I thought I didn't care if my father was proud of me or not, but here I was going out of my way to prove something to him. I don't know why it mattered. Showing him the check was supposed to be me giving him the finger, but maybe I was just a son looking for his dad's approval. He was impressed by the check. He thought it was fake at first. After he saw me becoming financially successful, he opened up a little. Mostly, though, we would just talk about things like his investments in the stock market, as he would offer business-related advice. We kept in touch over the years, and we never had any sort of falling out, but we were never close. And it wasn't that he didn't try. It was that the act of him trying was always painfully awkward and unnatural. Once I went to visit him when he was living in Palm Springs, and he showed up at the airport with a NoFX shirt, spiked bracelets, and dyed orange hair. He brought a copy of the local newspaper, which, per his request, had run a small story in one of the back pages about Fat Mike from NoFX coming to Palm Springs for a visit. I could tell he cared, but I didn't know how to react to a weird gesture like that, and he didn't know how to communicate in any other way. Once or twice a year, I flew down for the weekend to play some rounds of golf in Palm Springs. But once I invited him to come up to play golf at Pebble Beach. He was well aware of the fact that there's an 8-month wait to get a tee time there. It's the golfing mecca. I thought it would be awesome for both of us. He just said, "Oh, no thanks," without even thinking about it. That hurt like fucking crazy. He didn't mind me coming to visit, but just like when I was a kid, he had no real interest in going out of his way to spend time with me at all. The gap between us never closed. For years, my dad had stress-related asthma attacks. He would go to the hospital and they'd medicate him, and the attacks would cease for a while. They'd start up again, and he'd repeat the cycle. And all that time, they never noticed he also had diabetes. The symptom that finally gave it away was dementia. He would tell a funny story, and then tell the same exact story 10 minutes later. And then again 10 minutes later. And then again 10 minutes later. And then again, 10 minutes later. By the time the doctors figured it out, there was nothing they could do. He got worse as the years passed, and his friends slowly stopped hanging out with him because his repetitiveness and forgetfulness became very uncomfortable. One day his wife called me and said, "Your dad's really sick, you should come down." I flew down to his house, where he had been hooked up to machines and was struggling to survive. His memory was nearly gone, but he remembered I was his son. The doctor said he only had a few months left, so I thanked him for being my dad and told him that I loved him. He said, "I don't know if I was that good of a father," and I told him, "You were fine." I didn't want to let him off the hook completely, but I didn't want to burden him with how resentful I was toward him either. I was raised not to lie, but he deserved to go peacefully. He didn't go peacefully. He survived for a long time after that, and every week I would get a call. He would have no memory of our previous conversation. He would say the same thing. "I don't know if I was that good of a father." And I had to repeat my farewells and my stock response, "You are fine." It always wrecked me. I cried and got so angry every time. I eventually told his wife to stop calling me. It was too depressing to keep living out the final conversation with my dad over and over again. It wasn't doing either one of us any good. She persisted, but I told her, "Look, he wasn't a good father to me. He wouldn't have told you this, but he barely ever wanted to see me. I'm not going to come see him just because he's sick." She finally said, "I understand." She called me a few months later to tell me that my dad had fallen in the shower and hurt himself. She called a few days after that to let me know that he had died. NoFX was in the middle of the 2006 Warped Tour at the time, so flying home for the funeral would have meant a series of canceled shows. Most of my dad's friends were from out of town, so we decided to hold off on the funeral for a few weeks to allow everyone to make travel arrangements. Warped Tour was swinging through Fresno in July. If I had to miss playing one city for the funeral, at least it was Fresno. I drank and did coke all night before the funeral. Our tour bus dropped me off in front of the synagogue, and I stumbled out wearing a disheveled suit after maybe 1 hour's sleep. My half-sister Jennifer greeted me, probably wondering why I looked like a drunker version of John Belushi. She had grown up like me, distant from our father, but she and I had kept in touch over the years. We watched all of our dad's friends get up and give speeches about how great a guy he was, how generous he was, how good of a friend he was, and we were both in tears. Our dad's friends probably thought we were crying because we missed our father. The truth is, we were crying because we never knew the guy they were all talking about. I didn't want to speak at the funeral. Aaron had suggested I prepare something because I had no idea how the day was going to go. I planned to say that I loved my dad and I wish I knew him better, but that was all I could think of that would be honest and kind. At the end of the service, his wife implored me to say something, but I resisted at first. The rabbi presiding over the funeral had said in his speech, "Paul was a father and a great golfer." So when I finally gave in to my dad's wife's request to speak, I got up and said, "First of all, my dad was a shitty golfer." He got a mild laugh from his friends. I followed it up as planned. I loved my dad. I wish I knew him better. And I returned to my seat. Darla was barely 2 years old when my father died. I brought her out to Palm Springs to meet him once, but she has no memory of him now. And the dementia likely erased any memory he had of her. At the end of it all, did I know my dad any better than Darla did?
Chapter 102, Smelly. Mike kept his head relatively clear during the punk voter days because he knew his politics were under the microscope. He wanted to stay sharp. And during Aaron's pregnancy and Darla's early years, he held it together pretty well. The problem may have been that he was holding it together so much at home that he needed a release. So he partied to a self-abusive extent when we started touring again. Throughout our cross-country tour with the loved ones in early 2006, Mike was always saying, "There's no more Darby Crash, there's no more Sid Vicious." He somehow felt obligated to take up the banner of the punk rock wastoid and take his drinking and drug use to the next level. I don't know if he was using it as an excuse for his declining behavior or if he was trying to design a new image for himself, but he wasn't the fun party drunk anymore. He was becoming a wreck. I've always known that Mike was unpredictable. Before every show, ever since the very first performance at the cafe, part of me wonders, okay, what are we going to get tonight? Because some nights Mike is a diamond and some nights he's a lump of coal. Depending on his mood or his substance intake, he may blabber on and angrily alienate the crowd and kill the flow, or he may land every joke and nail every song and leave everyone wanting more. On that Loved Ones tour, it was coal almost every night. He screwed up the songs, ran off to the side of the stage to talk to friends in the middle of the set, and wasn't funny. Part of being punk is that you're not supposed to give a shit. Well, I give a shit. I want to be known as a tight, funny, good band, not a drunk, sloppy, careless band. I felt like Mike was trying to sabotage the shows on purpose. He was trying to make some sort of "there's no more G.G. Allin" point, but really he was just undoing everything we'd worked so hard to accomplish. And do you know why there's no more Darby Crash, Sid Vicious, and G.G. Allin, by the way? Because all those motherfuckers are dead, that's why. The bullshit built up as the tour went on, and the inevitable reckoning came in Washington, D.C. During the show, Mike put out two lines of coke on his amp. and he and Melvin snorted them right in front of me. Up to that point, I had tolerated their drug use with relatively little complaining, but snorting a line of coke right on stage felt like a slap in the face. It was stupid rock star ego bullshit. Look at me, I'm doing coke. And for all of our cheeky lyrics and adult sensibility, there's a fine line of responsibility that is definitely crossed when you're doing cocaine in front of a mostly young, impressionable crowd. Yeah, maybe I sound like a grown-up talking about protecting the children, but the way I see it, if we feel enough of a responsibility to tell people how to vote, we should probably feel just as much of a responsibility to be real with them about drug abuse. And I've seen enough friends die to know just how fucking impressionable kids can be. Mike always contends that drugs are fine in moderation as long as you don't stray into addiction. But I can tell you firsthand that addiction is not a choice. But mainly, I felt completely disrespected. I had been respecting their party space for over a decade, and they couldn't wait two more songs and take their drugs out of my sight? I walked out of the club to go to our hotel the second our set was over. I was ready to explode. My anger had been building not only since the beginning of the tour, but since August of 1992. Ever since I got out of rehab, I had worked hard to manage my emotions and keep myself in check. And I was being tested every night we played. Those guys couldn't give a fuck about my sobriety or what I had to go through every night on tour just to keep myself from punching the walls. After more than 20 years together, I was ready to quit NOFX. Fuck Mike, fuck Melvin, fuck it all. I was a ball of volcanic rage. As I walked out of the club, a fan saw me and said, "You fucking sucked." It wasn't a friendly jab. He honestly felt ripped off, and he was completely justified in his opinion, but he picked the wrong moment to express it. "What'd you say, motherfucker?" I didn't want to go to the hotel anymore. I wanted to beat this kid into the ground. He was going to bear the brunt of all of my hostility, and it was going to be biblical. "You guys fucking suck. I'm pissed. Fuck you guys." "I'm fucking pissed too, dude. You want me to show you how pissed I am?" I got within 10 feet of the kid when my friend Sean jumped between us and held me back. Thank God he did, because attacking that kid would have been the worst mistake ever. Who could blame him for calling us out on our shitty show? Why was I willing to punch a guy I totally agreed with? My brain snapped back into reasonable mode, and I continued down the road to our hotel. I stewed about it all night. I called friends for advice and had arguments with Mike and Melvin in my head. On a piece of Holiday Inn stationery, I wrote a letter mainly directed at Mike, recounting the history of our friendship. We used to sit down and talk for hours. We had things in common, but everything had changed. I felt like we had grown so far apart that mutual respect was no longer a priority for him, and that fucking hurt. I wrote that I loved Mike and Melvin, and that I loved the band, but if they couldn't offer me the same respect I had been affording them, then the band would be jeopardizing my sobriety, and I couldn't stay. When I got on the bus the next day, I didn't talk to anyone. I was still fuming. I just rode from D.C. to Atlantic City in my bunk, wondering if this tour would turn out to be my last. The friends I called from my hotel room had advised me not to make any decisions while I was still upset. In Atlantic City, I called a band meeting and read everyone my letter. Mike apologized right away. Then he included the word "but," and I stopped him. "I don't want to hear it. I've been hearing excuses for a long time." He clammed up. I actually got more of a pushback from Melvin, who said something like, "Dude, you were just looking to get mad at us. You were trying to see what we were doing. You're on the stage that I'm on. I'm not trying to see what you're doing. You're doing coke right in front of me." They both quickly realized how far I must have been pushed to sit and write a letter and insist on my first ever band meeting after all that time. I handed Mike the letter, and he and Melvin both apologized again. We ended the meeting amicably and met up with a photographer for a scheduled shoot. The pictures taken that day tell the whole story. The other guys are all together, posing and mugging for the camera. I'm off to the side, buried inside my own head. We didn't talk much that night or the next day. We played a show in New York City and barely made eye contact on stage, in the dressing room, or on the bus. I knew Mike and Mel were sorry, but I was still pissed and hurt. The meeting had made things awkward, so I wasn't sure if the guys were avoiding me because they were upset or if they were just giving me space to cool down. But we were all on edge. Then came Worcester, Massachusetts. Mike was drinking with some local punk kids in a bar across from the club before the show, and he downed his usual volumes backstage. When we got on stage, he was hammered, and in the middle of the set, he had lost all coordination. We were playing The Bruise, one of our easier tunes, and instead of playing B, E, F sharp, he belly-flopped off the front of the stage into the barricade. 15 years earlier, we had kicked Dave Casillas out of the band for getting too drunk and falling off stages, and he was just the guitar player, not the guy who was supposed to be steering the whole ship. The next day, we held an intervention, and I wasn't the one who organized it. We had all watched Mike get worse over the course of the tour. We were not only concerned for his well-being, but also generally embarrassed to be around him. The band was sick of playing sloppy, awful shows, and the crew was sick of mopping Mike off the floor at the end of the night. Unlike the meeting a few days earlier, Mike deflected the complaints this time. There's no more Gigi, there's no more Darby Crash, punk is about excess. We stood firm and I told him he wasn't Gigi Allen. He needed to be himself. Ever the great rationalizer, he offered a compromise. He wouldn't stop drinking, but he would stop taking Valium. That was the pact we made in order to move forward. He broke that pact at the next night's show. He adjusted his promise, saying he would take Valium, but only half instead of two holes. It wasn't long before that pact was broken too. In Mike's defense, the shows did improve after the meeting. He was still mixing too much booze with his pills, but Worcester was thankfully an isolated incident. That summer, we brought two buses on the Warped Tour, one for me and one for Mike. I don't know what he did on his bus all summer. I was just happy to be removed from it all. And around the same time, we established a party room and a sober room in every backstage area so I could hang out and be quiet and boring and Mike could do drugs and get weird, and also be boring. Mike has never fucked up as bad as he did on that tour, but I still think he has some issues with substance abuse that need to be fully resolved and that may cause serious problems for him down the line. We have held several other similar semi-interventions for him since then. That's probably a sign. When Mike's mom was dying, he called me up. I went down to his mom's house in Laguna Beach to keep him company while he awaited the inevitable. For several days, I did my best to distract him with idle chat while his mom was upstairs approaching death. I felt for the guy. He wasn't afraid to let me see him cry from time to time, and I wasn't afraid to comfort him like a brother. Regardless of what happened in Worcester and D.C., there's a deeper bond between all of us as bandmates that allows us to bury our differences in the past. I may not agree with every choice Mike makes, but I'll love the guy until the end. Whatever happens to us in the moment is never greater than the sum of all that has happened to us since we met. We've been through too much together.
Chapter 103, Hefe. Mike still doesn't believe me when I tell him he pulled his pants down, bent over, and slapped his ass in front of the Worcester crowd. But he did. We played badly on that whole tour. But in Worcester, I was watching people walk out of the show. Everything after the first four songs was a total embarrassment to all of us. Smelly was pacing in the dressing room afterwards, ready to kill. I feel like I want to fucking punch him. I tried to calm him down. Dude, just go to your room. I know you're pissed, and you have every right to be. I told the crew to block the door and keep Mike out. I knew if the two of them saw each other, it would go nuclear. Smelly had steam shooting out of his ears, and Mike had coke and booze shooting through his blood vessels. There was no way it was going to be a calm discussion from either end. I'm fucking ready to quit the band. He wasn't kidding. After Smelly stormed out, we all wondered what the morning would bring. The crew tried to talk to Mike, but he was drunk, belligerent, and unapologetic. We honestly weren't sure if NoFX had just played its last show. Smelly had warned Mike that he was becoming an addict years earlier, before cocaine was even in the picture. We were in Europe with the Vandals, and every night Mike would pop his Valium and drink his Lambrusco just to summon the energy to get on stage. Mike even said out loud that he couldn't play sober anymore and that he needed booze and pills just to have fun. Smelly explained patiently that wine and pills would eventually lead to something worse. He wasn't suggesting Mike would end up as a heroin addict, but he had enough experience with addiction to recognize the symptoms. Mike thought Smelly was overreacting. I had spent enough time with addicts to know that he wasn't. After the brief intervention brought on by the Worcester show, Mike and Smelly settled their differences and found a way to be respectful of each other's space. But Mike still can't perform sober. I'm not saying it never happens. I've seen him go for a day or two here and there. But then we all hear about it. Look, I just did this show sober. Hey, I'm sober today, everybody. See? Sober. If you have to broadcast it, it means you're trying to prove you don't have a problem. And if you're constantly trying to prove you don't have a problem, you have a problem.
Chapter 104. Mike. Brian Baker is part of the band that coined the phrase straight edge, as shorthand for a person who doesn't drink or do drugs. These days, he likes to mention that fact right before snorting a line of coke, and it's fucking funny every single time. When Bad Religion and NoFX were paired on various Warped Tours, Brian was always my pill, booze, coke party buddy. If I'm on tour somewhere and awake in the wee hours of the night, whacked out of my skull, I will often drunk dial Brian because chances are he will be equally awake and skull whacked. So when Brian Baker came to me after a 2006 show in Washington, D.C. and said, "Dude, take it down a notch," I knew I'd crossed a line. I dialed back my drinking and drug use significantly after Darla was born. But whenever I was on the road, I felt like I was off the leash. My drinking and drug routine on tour works 9 times out of 10, but it's still a very delicate chemistry experiment, prone to failure when things like a lack of dinner allow more booze into the system, or when a sprained ankle encourages me to take an extra painkiller or two. I was bound to get the math wrong sooner or later. I was mixing 10 to 20 milligrams of Valium with 4 or 5 martinis every night on our 2006 U.S. tour, and I stopped eating dinner before shows as well. Somewhere around the middle of our set, at our D.C. show, I decided it would be a good idea to smash one of my martini glasses on my head, and I thought it would be an even better idea to spread out lines of coke on my amp and snort them with Melvin in front of the crowd. Smelly didn't like that last idea. He was furious, and he had every right to be. He prized his sobriety and had made every effort to maintain it while the rest of us partied around him. He had learned by that point to avoid our pre-show warm-ups and our after-show parties, but here I was, shoving it in his face where he couldn't escape it. After 22 years as a band, we were about to have our first real argument. When I walked off the stage, he said, "Stay the fuck away from me," and disappeared. I didn't see him for the next 3 days, other than when we were on stage together. The booze and pills were keeping me oblivious to everything anyway. When we hit Worcester 3 days after D.C., I rolled out of my bus bunk in my pajamas and didn't bother changing before walking to a nearby bar. I got super loaded and went straight from the bar to our show, where I played horribly in between my endless, unfunny babbling. Toward the end of the set, I stumbled off the front of the stage and fell into the barricade, breaking the fall with my face and scarring my arm. The crowd thought it was funny, but it was actually pretty fucked up and scary. The crew pulled me back on stage and we tried to plow through 2 more songs, but strangely enough, they didn't go any better than the previous ones. Melvin closed the show with his accordion solo from our song Theme from a NoFX album, but I wouldn't leave the stage. Jay and the crew had to tackle me and drag me off, and I didn't go quietly. I was grabbing wires and monitors and kicking and squirming the whole way. This was not rock bottom for me, but later that night, I was on the receiving end of my first intervention. Some people, when they are intervened upon, try to fight their way out of it, or shift the blame to others, or take offense. I already knew I had been an asshole, so I immediately apologized and told Smelly he was right to be pissed at me. No one was demanding I go to rehab or quit cold turkey. They just wanted me to manage myself more responsibly, and it seemed like a reasonable request. I agreed to adjust the chemistry experiment by cutting my pre-show volume dosage in half, balancing my food booze intake, and watering down my drinks a bit. We also instituted a punishment reward system. If I screwed up too much on stage, Jay would confiscate my drink. And if I played 3 songs without a mistake, I could have it back. We also decided that we would, from that point on, have a sober dressing room and a separate party dressing room backstage. It worked well and has kept our band more or less argument-free since then. There have been other nights when I've gone too far, and there's been one more intervention, but hey, I'm no quitter.
Chapter 105, Hefe. My mom was always a fighter. She kept her diabetes at bay for decades, but by the time she was in her 70s, she went blind in one eye and had to go in for dialysis treatments 3 times a week. When I married Jen, the doctors told me our first Christmas together would be my mom's last. So Jen agreed to celebrate Christmas in Sacramento with my family. We celebrated my mom's last Christmas for at least 6 or 7 more Christmases. Like I said, she was a fighter. My mom faced countless challenges over the years, but she ultimately led a happy, productive life. She raised a loving family and left a legacy in the form of the health clinic she founded. She got to see me achieve my dream of playing music for a living, and she got to meet her grandson before she passed. She'd like to say my success was a gem in her crown. I knew she was proud of me, and she knew I loved her. I was sad when she died, but at least I was able to make peace with it when it happened. I wasn't, however, prepared for my brother to go before her. One day I was watching TV, and some doctor from Berkeley was talking about Gulf War syndrome and how some scientists had discovered a dangerous reaction between a standard anti-nerve gas pill issued to the American soldiers and DEET, D-E-E-T, the main chemical in most bug sprays. My older brother, Henry, was an Army sergeant who had served in both Gulf Wars, so I called him to ask if he had taken any anti-nerve gas pills during his deployment. He said he had. I asked him if he had used mosquito spray while he was serving. Of course he had. And he had also signed some waiver that prevented him from being able to sue the government if the anti-nerve gas pill had any ugly side effects. I didn't hear much more about Gulf War syndrome on TV after that, but it wasn't long before some of the guys in Henry's squad started getting sick and dying. The government blamed Saddam Hussein and insisted he had used chemical agents to poison our troops. They also insisted that the troops avoid civilian doctors and only share their medical concerns with the VA hospital. I had just landed in Germany to begin a European tour when Jen called to tell me my brother had been diagnosed with oral cancer. He had surgery to remove part of his tongue, and we thought he was in the clear. But 8 or 9 months later, the cancer came back with a vengeance and snaked its way under his jaw and back into his neck. The doctors tried to help, but there was nothing else they could do. My brother began the slow process of withering away. It's impossible to say for sure whether Henry's cancer had anything to do with the pills or the DEET or something else the Army or Saddam put in the air or just too much junk food. But something brought my brother down hard, and it was the ugliest and most evil thing I'd ever seen. Henry went from a chiseled military build to a fragile waif in no time. Within a few months of his diagnosis, he was in constant, excruciating pain and confined to a wheelchair. His jaw and neck were so swollen, he could barely talk, and he was sensitive to loud noises. Being the patriot he was, the 4th of July was his favorite holiday, so the family got together for a party at his house, and we wheeled him outside when it was time for the fireworks. He couldn't take the noise for long, though. We wheeled him back into his bedroom, knowing they were the last fireworks he'd ever see. Henry's last days were spent in the hospital, with a steady flow of morphine to ease his pain. When I went to see him, he was knocked out, but when he heard my voice, he picked up his head and opened his eyes. The nurses told me he hadn't moved like that since he was admitted. We had to whisper in his ear for him to hear us. He couldn't speak, but he could communicate a little by nodding. I told him I was there for him, along with everyone else in our family. He was about to leave behind 4 children. I told him not to worry. We'd all be watching over them. He nodded in understanding. I got the call a few days later. Jen came home and found me sitting by our piano, crying. What made it all the more tragic was that my mom had to experience the loss of her son less than 1 year before her own death. If life were fair, the sequence would have at least been reversed, but then again, if life were fair, my mom and my brother would still be here.
Chapter 106, Mike. I was giving my mom and her 70-year-old friend a tour of my house one day while a repairman worked on my TV. Somehow he pushed a button that turned on the DVD player, which happened to contain a video from my vast library of kinky porn. On the TV screen, a girl was tied to the ceiling while another girl whipped the shit out of her. My mom stood there and watched. Considering that that it was the most embarrassing moment of my life, my voice was surprisingly calm when I said, "Dude, can you switch this off?" The repairman looked at the screen and said, "Oh shit," as he fumbled with the remote and shut off the TV. My mom and I never spoke about the incident until years later when she was about to die. Cancer, unfortunately, ran in my mom's family. Her mother and grandmother both died of ovarian cancer. So when she was in her 50s, the doctors told her she should get a hysterectomy because it was inevitable she would develop ovarian cancer too. Every few weeks, I bugged my mom, "We have to book your surgery." And every time, she made an excuse to put it off. She had never had surgery before. She was just scared. After 2 years of nagging, I didn't have to nag anymore. She called me and told me the diagnosis we'd been dreading had come in. I was pissed. Really pissed. It happens so often in your life. You tell people what they should do over and over, and they don't do it. And they pay the consequences. You can't force someone to do something, no matter how much it would help them. It's the most frustrating thing in the world, and you usually just have to sigh and let it go. But this was a really tough one to shrug off. They tried the hysterectomy after they found the cancer, but the cancer came back. She underwent chemo for 6 months after the surgery. A year and a half later, the cancer came back. More surgery and 6 more months of chemo. A year later, the cancer came back. The cancer attached itself to my mom's digestive tract, so the doctors kept cutting away at the valves that control her bowel movements. After the 3rd round of surgery and chemo, the doctors said the next round would mean having to install a colostomy bag. Within 6 months, the fucking cancer came back. When you go through chemotherapy, you're exhausted and nauseous for days on end. You throw up and you can't eat, you lose your hair, your muscles deteriorate. Then the treatment starts to wear off and you're fine for a couple days, which reminds you just how nice it is not to be in pain. And then the next treatment begins and everything hits you all over again. It's utter misery. After several 6 month stretches of the whole fucking cycle and with no end in sight, my mom had had enough. She wanted to live out her remaining days, however many there were, as an adult. She declined the chemo and the colostomy bag and chose life. She came to No Effect shows and drank and smoked pot and fucked her boyfriend and enjoyed herself while she still could. I visited her all the time and made sure she spent plenty of time with Darla. Darla was only about 3 years old when my mom was dying, but she has very vivid memories of her grandma. Aaron's mom had 7 grandkids total, but Darla was my mother's only grandchild, so my mom gave crazy amounts of attention to her. In the spring of 2007, Aaron, Darla, and I all moved down to my mom's house in Laguna Beach because it was clear that her time was almost up. Her friends came by, my friends visited, her boyfriend was there, the beach was just outside. It was warm and pleasant, and exactly how she wanted to spend her last days. After 2 weeks, she went downhill fast. She was still coherent, but her muscles and organs were giving out, and it was visible to anyone who looked at her. Darla came into her room one day and innocently asked, "What's wrong with Grandma's face?" I told Aaron it was probably time for her and Darla to say their final goodbyes and head back home. I stayed in Laguna, and a few days later, my mom asked me to kill her. I was hanging out with her and her 5 friends, and she said she didn't want to suffer for weeks on end. If it came to that point, I want you guys to end this. No one would agree to do it, but I said I would. She made it clear to the room that there was no second guessing after the fact. "I give Michael permission to kill me. I might not be able to say anything then, so I'm telling you now." We all understood, and a few days later it was clear that I would have to keep my word to her. The night before she died, her boyfriend and I stayed up all night with her, drinking Jameson and telling stories. She couldn't talk anymore, but I told her every crazy story I could think of. Every sex story, every drug story, every crime I committed as a preteen, every girl I snuck over to the house, everything I talked about in this book, and some stories that I would never dare to include. I reminded her about the time she caught me with the porn in the DVD player, and the time she found a writing crop in my suitcase, and I finally explained that the locked door she always wondered about in my house led to a fully equipped rubber dungeon. I laughed harder and longer than I had in a long time as I confessed all my sins. I had managed to punch a hole in the cloud that had been surrounding us since my mom declined chemo. And my mom, she had a smile on her face the whole time. The next day she had difficulty breathing. I decided to breathe with her, to understand what she was going through. I lay in bed next to her and tried to match the pattern of her breaths. The inhales were short and sharp. The exhales were slow and long. After a minute, I wasn't getting enough air, and I realized that she wasn't either. She had stopped using oxygen because she thought she would go faster, but as her muscles gave out, she started suffocating. The doctor said to keep her heavily sedated and hooked up to the machines, and she wouldn't feel anything. But I was watching her drown. I started crying. I knew this was the moment. I said very clearly, "Mom, I know you can't speak right now, but I don't think you're getting enough air. Do you want me to kill you right now?" She hadn't moved or spoken in 3 days, but she summoned every ounce of strength she had left. Her body lurched upward as she pushed out a gasp. "Yes." I talked with the doctor friend who told me to give her all the pills that I could. Between that and the morphine she was already on, it should do the job. I crushed up a ton of pills and cooked up like 10 shots. I didn't know what I was doing, but I called a friend who was a nurse to help me. The machine that delivered her morphine through an IV is locked and designed to only deliver small doses. So I tore open the bag and gave her another 10 injections of morphine. But she didn't die. Her eyes were closed, and she was making these horrible choking noises all night. Doing this deed was hard enough, but failing at it made it worse. Her breath would get really slow, and I would think, okay, it's going to happen now. But it just wouldn't happen. I called my doctor friend in the morning and explained what was going on. He said that her liver was probably still processing everything, and that's why her heart wouldn't shut down. It took 36 hours from that first so-called lethal injection until she finally let go. If I could do it all over again, I would have just put a pillow over her face. It would have been much harder for me to muster the courage to do it, but it would have been over for her in 5 minutes. Instead, I waited until she had drawn her last breath, and then put a pillow over her face, just to cover her up. She didn't look peaceful. Her eyes and mouth were hanging half open. It was a face I didn't want to remember, but I do. The rest of the afternoon was paperwork and phone calls. I didn't cry or wallow. I just took care of business. The hospital came to take back their equipment and asked what happened to the bag on the morphine IV machine. It must have torn or something. They didn't ask any follow-up questions. They understood. I was officially an orphan. Even though it was one of the saddest moments of my life, I felt proud. I was happy my mom's suffering had ended. And I was happy I got the chance to spend that last month saying goodbye and thanking her for raising me. Not many people are allowed that luxury. Not many people get to say what they really mean when it really counts. If the shoe had been on the other foot and I had been on my deathbed with my mom at my side, I don't know what kind of stories she would have told me. She was always so open with me, sometimes too open. Once she was dating a guy and considered breaking up with him, she said to me, to her son, "I don't know, Michael. His cock is just so big. I just can't take it." And people wonder where my sense of tact and social grace comes from.
When she asked me to kill her, I said, of course I would. She had another week or two, but why should she suffer? Then my daughter came into the bedroom and asked, what's wrong with Grandma's face? My mother decided she wanted to die with grace. I said, Mama, are you sure you want this to happen to you right now? She said, yes, please end it, sweetie. I can't live in this much pain. I'd like to die surrounded by the people I most love. I brought you into this world, you gotta take me out. My life's greatest decision took just 1 millisecond. ethics turned to instinct and prim into respect. I grinded 20 oxys and 30 Percocet. I was told that would be more than enough. It turns out she was stronger than anyone had thought. Her brain wanted to turn off, but it couldn't convince her heart. Her eyes stuck halfway open, her mouth shaped a death frown. After 20 hours, her body would not shut down. I told everyone to leave the room. This was a solo sin. I said goodbye, I kissed her, and shot her with insulin. The death rattle, her last battle, my mind could never erase. So I held a pillow gently on her face. Tag me what you need to. An attack. Fill my veins with cold blood. Color my heart black. My mom gave me the greatest life anyone could ever live. So I gave her the greatest gift that I could give.
Chapter 107, Melvin. Around the time when my cafe was closing in the mid-90s, I finally opened up to my mom about being molested by our neighbor. I was seeing a therapist and practicing the skill of opening up and looking inside myself. My mom and I were hanging out at my house one day, and out of nowhere, she apologized to me for being so strict when I was a kid. She said she felt like she was mean to me, and confessed that she felt bad for raising me with too many rules and boundaries. I, of course, forgave her. And then, since she had just shared her heaviest burden, I decided to share mine. She didn't know how to take it. Like any parent, she was shocked and saddened. I softened the blow by reminding her that I came through it okay and that I was surrounded by good people and I was working through it. That made her feel a bit better. Not long after our discussion, my mom was hospitalized with sticky platelet syndrome, which is a disorder that caused her blood to clot more than it should. She survived a cardiac arrest and had to undergo a blood transfusion, but she came through it all fine and was able to manage her condition with medication. When I heard the word chemotherapy years later, I assumed the sticky platelets were acting up again and didn't think much of it. I got married in the summer of 2007, and my mom was dancing and healthy at my wedding. But within a year, I found myself driving her to chemotherapy appointments. I assumed it was simply a new treatment for her old problem. You would think at some point someone would have mentioned the word leukemia. It's a heavy word with ominous implications. But my mom had a way of suffering in silence. She didn't want us to fuss over her. My parents should have been communicating what was going on, and I should have been communicating my fears and concerns. But instead, we went on as we always did, conversing about practicalities and minutiae and never delving far enough below the surface to scratch up any emotion. When I returned to LA a few months later, I found my mom emaciated in a hospital bed. She was pale and bald from the chemo, but the most heartbreaking thing to witness was her exhaustion. She was always so sociable, but now, whenever someone came to visit, she would tire quickly from the effort of talking. I didn't need to hear the word leukemia anymore. I saw it right in front of me. After a couple weeks in the hospital, the doctors decided she could come home, as long as she had the proper medical equipment and supervision. I don't think I was naive enough to believe she was going to get better, but I also wasn't processing the idea that sending her home meant her final days were upon us. My mom, on the other hand, was keenly aware of the end. My mother-in-law at the time visited her in the hospital and told me later that my mom had told her, "You'll have to be a grandmother for both of us." We cleared out the living room at my parents' house and put a hospital bed near the TV. A nurse came regularly and gave us instructions for which drugs to give my mom when and what number to call if something happened. I would wake up in the morning and make tea for both of us, and we would talk. But she never said anything as heavy to me as she did to my mother-in-law. I suppose she didn't want to burden me, but we also never talked about the stuff we probably should have talked about. It was our last chance to finally say goodbye, and we both blew it. Most people aren't lucky enough to have that kind of warning before a parent passes away. It was a chance to finally open up to each other, to finally end the curse of emotional silence that we've been perpetuating our entire lives. We just chatted about the weather and how she'd slept the night before and sipped our tea. The unfortunate truth is that a talkative person is not necessarily a communicative person. In September 2008, NoFX had a show booked in Phoenix, some radio festival thing with Pennywise and Rise Against. I didn't really want to go, but it was a huge show, and it was way too late to cancel. The band might have suggested I stay home if only I'd been communicative enough to explain what I'd been going through, but you know how that goes by now. The plan was to fly out, play, and fly home early the next morning. I would only be gone for 12 hours. It didn't seem like a big deal. I flew out, played the show, and fell asleep. I woke up to a dozen missed calls from my dad. I never saw my mom again. When I stepped on stage in Phoenix, I thought, this one's for my mom. You would think I'd remember very little about the show with so much swirling through my head, but strangely, my memories of the motorhome dressing rooms and the enormous outdoor stage and the sun setting as we played were more vivid than most of my tour memories from that era. I don't think I offered too many details about my mom to the guys in the band. I still wasn't really prepared for her to die. I came home to an empty hospital bed in the living room. My parents had already made all the arrangements for her burial plot, so my sister, my dad, and I dealt with the cemetery people and squared things away. We picked a headstone and an inscription, and I did my best to keep my dad company, while never really talking about her grief or the simple fact that we missed my mom. What the hell is wrong with us? The loss didn't set in until her memorial service. It was a beautiful, perfect, sunny Los Angeles day. We were surrounded by a crowd of loving and supportive friends and family. Butterflies floated through the air. The tranquility took the edge off the somberness. I guess we were there to place her urn in the ground, but the whole day was such a blur that I don't even remember if that happened or not. What I do remember is the moment they pulled the tarp off the burial plot. Just as they revealed the hole they had dug in the earth, this little brown rabbit with white feet came bounding out of it and took off into the bushes. Some people let out a gasp. A few laughed uneasily at the release of tension. My mom's friend Walter said, "That's Elaine right there." And I broke down into heavy sobbing. I don't know what it was about those words, but after the hospital and the sickness and the six missed calls, and the empty hospital bed, and the hole in the earth, the dam finally burst. I cried my eyes out as the reality I'd been foolishly denying all along finally sunk in. My mom was dead. My son Eli was born 2 years after my mom passed, and my son Caspian was born a few years later. Not a week goes by without one of them doing something cute or silly, or imaginative, that makes me wish I could share it with her. They even remind me of her in some of their features, like Caspian's distinctive chin, or the way Eli shows his lower teeth when he makes goofy faces for a camera, just like she used to do. I've tried hard to block out the memory of my mom in that hospital bed. I spent a lot of time looking at old photos to remind myself of when she was active and healthy. I keep lots of pictures of her on the wall in our house, and I find myself talking to them all the time. I seek her advice. I vent my frustrations about parenting. It's sad to think that I have deeper conversations with her photos than I did with her when she was around, but she still manages to give me strength. Sometimes I feel guilty for not being able to save her. I've since read up on diets and nutrition, and maybe if I'd told her to stop eating sugar or caffeine or something, it would have somehow made a difference. But who knows if that would have done anything. What would have made a bigger difference would have just been opening up to her, telling her I cared, thanking her for passing down her creative spirit, thanking her for teaching me that we're never too old to learn something new, thanking her for everything. I took it for granted that she'd always be there, but maybe not every conversation with my mom needed to be fraught with emotions and gratitude and heavy revelations about the past. She was there. She was part of my life, and I was part of hers. I knew I was loved. She knew she was loved in return. Maybe that's all that matters.
Chapter 108, Smelly. Before I got clean, I was living in a North Hollywood junkie house called Funland. The name could not have been more misleading. The standout memory I have from that place was the time a bunch of FFF gangsters showed up to one of our keggers and started a 20-on-20 brawl with some other gang dudes at the party. I was in the driveway watching things get gnarly as my friend Chris went toe-to-toe with some big FFF dude, but I lost track of Chris when I heard the distinct sound of someone racking a pump-action shotgun behind me. The FFF guy holding it shouted, "Anybody want some?" and half the party scattered. Then a dozen cop cars showed up and everyone else scattered. While the police patted me down, I noticed a pool of blood and a clump of Chris's hair left behind in the driveway. When I came home from our 1992 European tour, I got a letter from the Van Nuys Police Department. One of my Funland friends, Karina, had borrowed my car while I was away, used it in an armed convenience store robbery, crashed it into a telephone pole, and fled the scene. Thankfully, my passport had stamps to prove I wasn't in the country at the time. Karina was pregnant when she went to jail for the robbery. She gave birth to a heroin-addicted baby while serving time. Her ex-boyfriend, Doc, one of my other junkie roommates, got custody of the kid. Doc always had a bit of a dangerous, sketchy vibe to him, but overall he was a fun guy and a good friend. But one day I picked up a copy of the LA Weekly, and there he was staring back at me from the cover. The headline read, "The Face of Evil." He subjected his poor son to regular, unspeakable physical abuse. When the kid was just over 2 years old, Duck beat him to death. His case was so shocking, it caused the state to re-examine its custody laws. The California legislature was taught a lesson that should have been obvious all along. Junkies and kids do not mix well. I got married in 2000 to a woman I'd known for about 4 months. We did the Vegas runaway thing on impulse. I thought I'd found the one, but we ended up divorced in 2010. Looking back, the red flag started flying at full mast a few months after the elopement when I got my first real glimpse of her extended family. All of them were fucked up in one way or the other, strung out on drugs, living in squalor, surviving off SSI. Total fucking train wrecks. My now ex-wife's aunt was a junkie with a husband behind bars. I first met their daughter, Joey, when she was only 3 years old. She was a beautiful, innocent baby girl with matted, brownish blonde hair who hadn't bathed or had a decent meal in who knows how long. Her sad brown eyes pleaded for help. I don't want to offer up too many details about the conditions Joey was living in with her mom, but earlier in this book, I've gone into detail about some of the foul, nauseating places where I rested my head during my heroin years. Imagine if I had a toddler with me. Now imagine it being 100 times worse than anything I've described. My heart broke when I met Joey for the second time at age 5 and found that her living situation had not improved. A few years later, her mom was arrested for child endangerment. We got a call from Child Protective Services and immediately offered her a place to live. I was a father overnight. It wasn't how I pictured it happening, but being a dad was something I'd wanted since I was a kid. My own childhood was so shitty, I wanted the opportunity to show somebody real, unconditional love. My dad had shown me what not to do. I couldn't wait to turn all of those negative experiences into something positive. Joey had just turned 8 and didn't know what to make of the whole situation. She had been living in tents and under freeways or spending nights in by-the-hour motels. She had been passed around to various other extended family members before, so she thought our house in Long Beach was yet another temporary situation. She was frightened and quiet, regardless of all the assurances that she was finally in a safe place. She would try to socialize with other kids, but her self-consciousness left her shaking and upset. She barely knew how to read or write, or even properly use a fork and knife. I made a promise to myself and, silently, to her. I was going to love her. I was going to protect her. I was going to give her every ounce of emotional support that I never got. I was going to be there for her 110%. And if that meant quitting the band, if that's really what it was going to take, I would accept that. A couple weeks after she arrived, we were walking into a Target. She does this funny little skip when she's happy. She was doing it then. She skipped up behind me and for the first time took my hand and held it. It fucking melted my heart, and it let me know I was on the right path. Over the next few months, I watched this damaged soul, who had seen way too much for her age, actually become a kid, riding a bike, playing with other kids, getting a somewhat normal life, which is all she ever wanted. She entered school in October 2006 and was placed in third grade, but she tested at below kindergarten levels in math and reading. She was a sharp kid, but she had been robbed of an education. By June, she had not only caught up to the level of her classmates, she had surpassed them. I put on a tie and attended an awards banquet at the end of the school year, where Joey was honored by the mayor of Long Beach with a plaque and the title of Most Inspiring Student in the Long Beach Unified School District. But of course there were, and still are, hurdles. Her whole life she had been discarded wherever she went. Everything that had been given to her had been taken away or left behind. The sadness and alienation can be overwhelming sometimes. Luckily, she has someone who can relate, my father. The cracks in my dad's hardened exterior appeared when he first went sober, and they grew when I went sober. But when my dad met Joey, the walls crumbled to dust. He had been abused and abandoned. He had moved from home to home and lived out of a suitcase. He and Joey were one and the same. When I told her about his past, it put her life into perspective. It showed her she wasn't alone, and it bonded them deeply. It helped her understand that even though we don't share blood, we're still family. The twist in the story is that while we were all so busy trying to heal Joey, she actually healed us. Having her around opened my dad up emotionally. He saw in her a second chance at his own childhood and a second chance to be a supportive parent. He takes her out cruising in his hot rod and shows her more affection than I ever saw from him when I was a kid. My mom always felt guilty for not standing up for me against my dad. So she gets a second chance at raising a kid without all the ugliness in the way. My mom and dad both get to feel a sense of pride from watching their screw-up son become a responsible, attentive father. And I get to bond with both of my parents by relating to their struggles, learning from their mistakes, and having them compliment me on how I'm handling parenthood. Joey has become the nucleus of the Sandin family. She has soothed so many deep wounds. A couple years back, when the sadness of the past crept back into her mind, as it occasionally does, we were crying and hugging and talking it out. When she asked me, "Why do I care so much about her?" I said, "I may be making a difference in your life, but you're making just as much of a difference in my life." She asked, "Why?" I said, "You give me purpose. I love you unconditionally. And my purpose is to make your life as good as possible. You gave me a reason to be on this planet." It's all true. Even the rough times as a parent have been fulfilling. If it was nothing but the roughest of the rough times with her for the rest of my life, I would still feel satisfied. If I had to, I would redo my shitty childhood 1,000 times over just to know what I know now to give Joey a good life. I would sacrifice my own happiness every time. I now know what true selflessness is. Meanwhile, my dad still hasn't quite gotten the hang of expressing his feelings. His heart has definitely been unlocked, and he's warm enough to offer hugs these days. But I still have never heard him utter the words, "I love you." I know he wants to say it, he just can't. Sometimes when my dad is over, I'll take Joey aside and whisper, "Joey, Tell Grandpa you love him. She'll sweetly intone, I love you, Grandpa. He'll grunt back over her shoulder, yeah, yeah, yeah. Or, I heard you. Or, what do you want from me? But maybe someday. Not that I'm one to talk. I've never told my dad I love him either. But the truth is, without him, I wouldn't be who I am. He taught me about music. He taught me about the value of hard work. Things may not have been ideal when I was growing up. But I know now that our situation was just as tough on him as it was on me. I have total respect for him. And considering how well things have ultimately turned out, I have to thank him for being the man he is. It's easier to say these things here, now, than it is to say them to his face, of course. I wonder if I'll ever get the courage to communicate, in person, just how much he means to me. For now, I hope he'll hear these words for the very first time. I love you, Dad.
Chapter 109, Mike. 1 year on my birthday, I was in our home dungeon when there was a knock at the door. It was Aaron, dressed in a full, shiny black latex catsuit, complete with the hood that covered her entire face. She said, in a seductive voice, "Your wife sent me," and gave me a special and severe birthday beating. Aaron enjoyed S&M, but never to the extent that I did. She went out of her way to indulge my perversities as much as she could, but there was still a wedge between us. I felt like she was playing a role I had written for her. I was living out some of my fantasies, but they were my fantasies, not hers. That's not what I wanted. With the sexual disconnect added to the weight of our sinking marriage, it's no surprise we went under. It was 40 minutes before NoFX was supposed to take the stage in Philadelphia in the fall of 2008, when yet another phone argument with Aaron spiraled into an unnecessarily big fight. It's an unwritten rule for people in relationships with people in bands. Don't start shit right before they go on stage. They'll carry the fight with them, and it will ruin the show for them and the crowd. This wasn't just a normal fight, though. This was the fight that made me decide to leave my wife. I said I was done. I couldn't do it anymore. After the tour, I was going to move out. She was crying, and I was ready to break. I used whiskey to keep myself together. Lots and lots of Jameson whiskey. After our whiskey-soaked show that night, I had a whiskey-fueled bus party with Patty from D4 and Dave from The Loved Ones. I cranked up the music in the bus lounge, and we started a three-man slam pit. Patty was doing stage dives off the table. Dave and Patty held me up as I was making footprints on the big mirror on the ceiling.